Katie Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
When you see Jesse Jackson, when my name goes in nomination, your name goes in nomination. I was born in the slum, but the slum was not born in me. And it wasn't born in you, and you can make it.
Tributes are pouring in for civil rights icon Reverend Jesse Jackson. He died Tuesday at the age of 84. We'll speak to Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign and our own Juan Gonzalez, who traveled to Cuba with Jackson to meet Fidel Castro in the early 90s. Then we get an update on the U.S.-Iran talks in Geneva as the U.S. expands its military presence in the Middle East. We then speak with longtime organizer Analila Mejia, who could soon be heading to Congress. She won last week's Democratic primary in New Jersey after running on a campaign accusing Israel of genocide and calling for ICE to be abolished.
I'm running to hold Trump and his allies accountable for their blatant corruption. I'm running to unrig our economy that favors billionaires over working people.
We also speak with Alexis Goldstein. She was recently fired from her job at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
About a week ago, I was fired from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because a year ago, I confronted some DOGE employees and asked their names and if they had the proper required training. This is what I'm supposed to do for my job, and because of it, I was retaliated against and terminated.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military says it's carried out strikes on three boats in the Caribbean and Pacific, killing at least 11 people, again providing no evidence that the boats were carrying drugs. Since September, the U.S. military has carried out 42 known strikes on small vessels in the waters near Latin America, killing at least 145 people. The recent strikes come weeks after the U.S. attacked Venezuela and abducted its president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, who are to face trial in New York on drugs, weapons, and narco-terrorism charges. The Washington Office on Latin America, an advocacy group, said, quote, "Those being killed by U.S. military strikes at sea are denied any due process whatsoever," unquote. As U.S. and Iranian officials held negotiations over Iran's nuclear program in Geneva, Switzerland, Tuesday, Iran temporarily closed parts of the Strait of Hormuz, a key international waterway through which 20% of the world's oil passes. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned, quote, "The strongest army in the world might sometimes receive such a slap that it cannot get back on its feet," unquote. Tehran's foreign minister cautioned more work still needs to be done in reaching a nuclear deal, but expressed some optimism about the negotiations.
"I can say that in this round, there were quite serious discussions and a more constructive atmosphere than in the previous round. Various ideas were raised, and these ideas were seriously discussed, and finally we were able to reach a general agreement on a series of guiding principles. From now on, we will move based on those principles and enter into the text of a possible agreement."
Meanwhile, Mehdi Mahmoudian, the Oscar-nominated co-writer of the film It Was Just an Accident, has been released from an Iranian prison. Earlier this month, he was arrested in Tehran after he signed a statement condemning Khamenei and the regime's violent crackdown on anti-government demonstrators. To see our interview with the filmmaker Jafar Panahi, go to democracynow.org. Peru's Congress has impeached interim Peruvian President José Jarí for failing to disclose meetings with Chinese businessmen who are under investigation. His ouster came just about 4 months after taking office. He's the former head of Peru's Congress, who also oversaw the removal of his predecessor, Dina Boluarte. And he is the sixth Peruvian president in the past decade to leave office before the end of a term. Residents of the capital, Lima, took to the streets to celebrate his impeachment.
Very good. Long live Peru. We're always standing, never kneeling. Now I tell my suffering people, which have been subjected to thousands of forms of slavery, never again. Not one more vote to these far-right parties. We will not trust them at all because they've proven their immorality and incapacity.
Peru is scheduled to hold a general election on April 12th. Here in the United States, a federal judge has blocked efforts by the Trump administration to rearrest Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father, who was wrongfully sent to El Salvador's notorious Secat mega prison last March. Since his return to the United States in June, Abrego Garcia has been fighting repeated deportation threats, as DHS has intended to send him to several African countries he has no ties to. U.S. District Judge Paula Zinnes said in a ruling Tuesday, the Trump administration, quote, made one empty threat after another to remove him to countries in Africa with no real chance of success. There's no good reason to believe removal is likely in the reasonably foreseeable future, she said. Abrego Garcia's legal team has said he had agreed to the possibility of being removed to Costa Rica, but Judge Zinnes blasted the Trump administration for, quote, purposely and for no reason ignored the one country that has consistently offered to accept Abrego Garcia as a refugee and to which he agrees to go, unquote. To see all our coverage of Kilmer Abrego Garcia's case, go to democracynow.org. In more related immigration news, an immigration judge has blocked the Trump administration from deporting Mohsen Mahdawi, a graduate of Columbia University who was detained last April over his outspoken support for Palestinian rights. Mahdawi is a green card holder from the occupied West Bank. He was arrested by ICE in Vermont when he appeared for what he was told would be a U.S. citizenship interview. He spent more than 2 weeks in ICE custody. After news of his deportation proceedings had been terminated, Mahdawi said in a statement, quote, in a climate where dissent is increasingly met with intimidation and detention, today's ruling renews hope that due process still applies and that no agency stands above the Constitution. This is not the end of the story. It's the beginning of a deeper commitment to peace, dignity, and justice, he said. To see our interviews with Mohsen Mahdawi, go to democracynow.org. Department of Homeland Security spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin, one of the most vocal supporters of President Trump's immigration crackdown and deportation campaign, is resigning. The move comes amidst intensifying scrutiny over DHS's use of deadly force and public backlash against President Trump's deployment of federal agents to Chicago, Minneapolis, and other cities nationwide. Earlier this year, Public Citizen reported McLaughlin's husband's company, the Strategy Group, was granted part of a $220 million contract to run an anti-immigration advertising campaign for DHS. ProPublica also reported last year McLaughlin's husband, Ben Yoho, worked on one of DHS Secretary Kristi Noem's ads filmed at Mount Rushmore. This comes as calls grow for Noem's impeachment and resignation. Following news of McLaughlin's departure, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said on social media, quote, another MAGA extremist forced out of DHS. Noem next. Keep the pressure on, he said. A two-month-old baby, Juan Nicolas, who became gravely ill while detained at ICE's South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, has been deported, along with his parents and 16-month-old sibling. That's according to Texas Congressmember Joaquin Castro, who had demanded the baby's release after news he'd been rushed to the hospital Monday. Baby Juan had reportedly been detained at the Dilley jail for about a month. Univision reporter Lydia Terrazas had spoken to Juan's mom, who told her the baby had suffered a health episode, choking on his own vomit. When he was taken to Dilley's medical area, guards were told there was no doctor available inside the jail at that time. In Bangladesh, the country's new prime minister, Tariq Rahman, was sworn in Tuesday after his party's landslide win in parliamentary elections. Rahman returned to Bangladesh last year after 17 years of self-imposed exile in the United Kingdom. Voters also approved a raft of changes to Bangladesh's constitution aimed at preventing authoritarianism. This comes after Bangladesh's former prime minister, Sheikh Hasina, was sentenced to death for ordering a deadly crackdown on student protesters who successfully toppled her government in 2024. The UN reports 1,400 people were killed and thousands were injured in the crackdown. In Minnesota, independent journalist Don Lemon also pleaded not guilty, along with four others, including protest leader and civil rights attorney Nakima Levy Armstrong. This is Georgia Fort speaking to supporters gathered outside the federal courthouse in St. Paul Tuesday. She called attention to the attacks on journalists in the United States and around the world.
This is a global crisis. According to Al Jazeera, more than 250 journalists and members of the media have been killed in Gaza. And most people don't even know about it.
Ever.
We live in a time when AI images and AI videos are shaping our world's reality, with a portion of our society living in delusion. So if you stand for truth, I need you to stand up today.
Again, in Minnesota, independent journalist Georgia Ford and activist Trehan Cruz pleaded not guilty in federal court in St. Paul yesterday. They were indicted on federal charges in connection with a protest last month at a St. Paul church where the pastor is also an ICE official. And Late Show host Stephen Colbert is accusing the Trump administration and CBS of censorship after the network informed The Late Show, according to Colbert, that he could not air an interview with James Tallarico, a Texas Democrat running for Senate. CBS said in a statement, quote, "The Late Show was not prohibited by CBS from broadcasting the interview with Texas State Representative James Tallarico. The show was provided legal guidance that the broadcast could trigger the Federal Communication Commission's equal time rule for two other candidates, including Representative Jasmine Crockett, and presented options for how the equal time for other candidates could be fulfilled," unquote. The FCC had previously issued an exemption for the equal time rule for news interviews, but earlier this year, FCC Chair Brendan Carr mentioned he was considering dropping the exemption specifically for talk shows. Earlier this month, the FCC opened an investigation into the ABC show The View, which also interviewed Tallarico. Colbert's interview with Tallarico was ultimately posted on YouTube outside the jurisdiction of the FCC. It garnered 5 million views. This is Stephen Colbert last night insisting CBS barred him from conducting his interview with Tallarico live on the Late Show broadcast.
Between the monologue I did last night and before I did the second act talking about this issue, I had to go backstage. I got called backstage to get more notes from these lawyers, something that had never, ever happened before. And they told us the language they wanted me to use to describe that equal time exception. And I used that language. So I don't know what this is about.
CBS is currently owned by Paramount Skydance, run by Trump ally David Ellison, the son of Oracle founder Larry Ellison, who's repeatedly visited the White House during President Trump's second term. Paramount has restarted talks with Warner Brothers Discovery to acquire the company after Warner Brothers previously rejected Paramount's hostile takeover bid last year. The takeover would require the approval of Trump's FCC. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi. Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, tributes are pouring in from across the globe for the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who died on Tuesday. The civil rights icon and two-time presidential candidate was 84 years old. In a statement, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said, quote, from Selma in the American South to Soweto in 1979, where he visited following the death of Steve Biko, Jesse Jackson defied the architects of apartheid and executors of brutality to declare that all people are equal and that justice would ultimately triumph over injustice, unquote. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres praised Jackson for his, quote, work against racism, against apartheid, and for human rights. Former President Obama cited Jackson's presidential campaigns in 1984 and 1988, saying, quote, in his two historic runs for president, he laid the foundation for my own campaign to the highest office in the land. This is an excerpt of the Reverend Jesse Jackson addressing the Democratic National Convention in 1988.
When you see Jesse Jackson, when my name goes in nomination, your name goes in nomination. I was born in the slum, but the slum was not born in me. And it wasn't born in you, and you can make it. Wherever you are tonight, you can make it. Hold your head high. Stick your chest out. You can make it. It gets dark sometimes, but the morning comes. Don't you surrender. Suffering breeds character. Character breeds faith. In the end, faith will not disappoint. You must not surrender. You may or may not get there, but just know that you are qualified. You hold on and hold out. We must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. On tomorrow night and beyond. Keep hope alive. I love you very much. I love you very much.
That was the Reverend Jesse Jackson in 1988 running for president. In a moment, we'll be joined by Bishop William Barber. But first, Juan, we want to turn to you. Juan Gonzalez has been covering Jesse Jackson for decades. Can you reflect on your time covering Reverend Jackson here and in other lands?
Yes, Amy. Well, I first met Jesse more than 40 years ago, back in 1983, as he was preparing his first run for president. I was a young reporter at the Philadelphia Daily News back then, and the first national presidential convention I covered was the 1984 DNC gathering in San Francisco, where Jesse gave his now legendary first convention speech, urging the Democratic Party to adopt a program of true social justice. A few years later, in 1990, during the historic five-month labor strike at the New York Daily News, where I chaired the strike committee of the Newspaper Guild, Jesse was pivotal in rallying support for our cause. He joined Governor Mario Cuomo, Cardinal O'Connor, Mayor Dinkins in speaking at a massive rally in support of our strike in front of the Daily News. And later during Christmas week in 1993, I traveled with Jesse, labor leader Dennis Rivera, and a handful of others to Cuba, where we met with Cuban leader Fidel Castro, and Jesse convinced Fidel to allow Fidel's granddaughter to leave Cuba and reunite with the U.S. with her mother, who defected. I was stunned at how many people in the streets of Havana instantly recognized Jesse and wanted to talk with him, and he spent time with them as well.
Juan, we're just showing a picture you can't see of Jesse Jackson sitting in a rocking chair. Can you explain what this is? This was in Cuba?
Right. Yeah, that's my favorite personal photo of him. Early one morning, I came down. We were in a guest house in Havana. I come down the stairs about 7 o'clock in the morning, and there is Jesse in his robe in a rocking chair reading the Bible. No one else in the room at the time.
Let me turn to Reverend Jesse Jackson as you talk about You covered Jesse Jackson in that meeting that you all had with Fidel Castro. This is Jackson speaking in Havana in 2013.
There are no rational security threats from us to Cuba. After we have Guantanamo base in Cuba, Russia is no longer as we knew it in the 60s in Cuba. There's no, Putin is not where Khrushchev was 60 years ago. And what would it mean to us except a market for telecommunications and cars and tourism? And what would it mean for Cubans? Food and development, we all stand to gain from pulling down blockades and building bridges. I am convinced if the wall between South Africa, white and black, could come down, the wall in East West Germany could come down, if we could begin to talk with Iran again after 35 years, now is the time to bring down this. There's a certain diplomacy spirit in the air. We should seize this moment to bring down this Cuban-American barrier.
So that was Jesse Jackson in Havana in 2013, one of many trips he made there. Juan was with him on one of those trips. Juan?
Yeah, and also back then in 1999, I again traveled with Jesse in a small group to the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico, where we met with the protesters who were occupying the U.S. Navy's bombing range on Vieques, demanding that that the Navy leave Vieques. And I specifically recall one point, because Jesse got so much press coverage on the island then, that the commander of the Roosevelt Roads Naval Base demanded a meeting with Jesse to explain the Navy's point of view. And he went on and on, the commander, about the importance of Vieques as a training facility for the U.S. military. And at one point, Jesse looks at him and says, "You don't get it. These people don't want you here. You know, you're like a man who keeps telling a woman yes, 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 and she tells you no, 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 and you won't listen. It's up. You have to leave. The Navy has to leave Vieques." And of course, about a year or two later, finally, it was President Bush that finally pulled the Navy out of Vieques. So basically, Jesse was always there when people were fighting for some form of social justice. He could always be counted on to show up, express public support. And of all the U.S. leaders of the past half century, I believe none had a more international view and a commitment to worldwide social justice as Jesse Jackson did. So those of us who knew him are all better for having known him. And it's a tremendous loss that he's gone.
So, Juan, you're speaking to us from Chicago, his longtime hometown. We're going to go right now to North Carolina to continue to talk about the life and legacy of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We're joined by Bishop William Barber, president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, founding director of the Yale Center for Public Theology and Public Policy. While you're joining us today, Bishop, from New Haven, you're usually in North Carolina. While Jesse Jackson was born in South Carolina, he went to school in North Carolina, as you did. Can you reflect on the significance, the life and legacy of Jesse Jackson, Bishop Barber?
Thank you so much, Amy and Juan. We just left a 50-mile walk in North Carolina. It's time to love forward together. This is our Selma. And in many ways, the way we organized it was what I learned with Jesse Jackson, broad and deep, black and white and brown and young and old and gay and straight and Asian and indigenous and multi-policy focused. Jesse Jackson, when I met him 40 years ago as a student, he asked me to work with his student campaign when he was running for president in 1984. And what we heard in him was not a politician. What we heard in him was somebody that was serious about people uniting to save humanity, pushing, that he was serious about an agenda of uplift. We didn't hear him just criticizing the person he was running against or demeaning them, a message we need to have today. He instead gave people a vision. He talked about moving from civil rights battlegrounds, the economic common ground. He talked about moving to moral high ground. He framed issues in a moral perspective using both Judeo-Christian traditions as well as the Constitution. And Jesse had a way, just like Juan said, of saying, if you can pull down the walls in Germany, if you can pull down the walls in South Africa, you can pull down the walls here in Cuba, you can pull down the walls of that keeps people in poverty and in ghettos right here. And that's the uniqueness. Jesse didn't just have a race critique. He had a race critique, but he recognized that a race critique alone was too limited. He remembered what Dr. King taught in 1965, at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March, that the greatest fear of the greedy oligarchs in this country is for the masses of black people and poor white people and others, Latinos, to join together and form a voting bloc that could fundamentally shift the economic architecture of this nation. He pushed us hard, Amy, on knowing policy and policy by adversaries and our own, knowing both sides, and that we didn't have to be about demeaning our adversary. What we needed to do was give people a vision of hope, and not just daydreaming and wishful thinking, but the kind of hope that grows out of building a movement. You know, people say he lost. He really didn't lose those two elections. He brought 10 million new people into the electorate. He changed rules in the Democratic Party. He lifted up an agenda for people who weren't even hearing their names talked about. He was one of the few candidates that talked about the poor openly, talked about whether it was in Iowa or in Alabama or Mississippi or New York or upstate Connecticut, wherever he was lifting up the people. And that is the part of the genius and the kind of hope that he kept alive over and over again. And he never stopped. Even when he got ill, we were in Texas walking 21 miles supporting people in Texas, and Jesse Jackson showed up 5 years ago. When we're in the middle of COVID, when we were fighting to make sure that poor and low-wage people would be treated as fairly, in COVID appropriations, Jesse Jackson just showed up one day when we were standing there fighting for voting rights and demanding that the COVID bill and restoring voting rights be done at the same time. And politicians didn't want to do that. Jesse showed up and we went to jail together. When we started, I got arrested together. When we started the reiteration of the Poor People's Campaign, Jesse had been the mayor of Solidarity City. He came and said, I'm not even here to lead it. I'm here to say it's about time that we pick this up 50 years later and that it is the right thing to do, because he recognized right now that we're not in a crisis of democracy or a crisis of a party. We're in the crisis of civilization. Something very flawed is happening when people think the only thing you do with power is hurt people and expel people and deport people and take people's health care and take people's living wages. Jesse's message is needed today. I would say everybody needs to go listen to 84 and 88 and listen to it and model much of it today in order for us to come up and out of the things that we are experiencing today.
And Reverend Barber, I'm wondering, you've often said that like Selma in 65 and Birmingham in 63, this is our moral moment now. Wondering if you could briefly tell us why.
Well, you know, one of the things when you listen, for instance, at the end of the Selma to Montgomery, when Dr. King gave his sermon on the steps of the Alabama State House, it's interesting that he broadened what he was talking about. He wasn't just talking about voting rights for black people. He laid out what could happen if we expanded voting rights. He laid out how it would shift the democracy itself. As we stand here right now, Jesse passed yesterday, and when his family called me, his son called me, we were praying as they were taking him out, his wife said, a mighty lion has fallen. That's what his son told me. And I think about the moral power of that lion is both protect and expand the pride. Well, right now, we have less voting rights today than we had August 6, 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was first passed. And Jesse would always teach us that voting rights wasn't just for black people. He taught what it did for white women, what it did for working people. We still do not have a living wage while we are making trillionaires greedy trillionaires and giving more and more money to the billionaires and the oligarchs. We don't have a living wage. Over 140 million people are poor and low wage. 87 million people are without health care or underinsured at a time where we're passing big, ugly, deadly, destructive bills that take health care. We also live in a time when even on the Democratic side, politicians won't say the word poor. They'll talk about affordability, but they won't say the word poor. Jesse would. And what he would say is that you can't just say rising tides, you know, help the middle class and everybody else will come up. He knew some boats were stuck. And he knew that you have to lift from the bottom, not merely rising tide, but lift from the bottom. And he had a way that we need now. We need to let people know something that he often said.